Hi, I'm Sally Hughes, and this is the return of Beyond the Bathroom, where each week I find out how my guests feel about their own appearance. What kind of relationship do they have with their own face and body? What are their go-to beauty routines? Are they obsessive about their appearance, or is it low on their list of priorities? And how have time and experience changed the way they feel about the way they look? Bearing all today is Jess Phillips, MP. A former domestic abuse refuges manager for Women's Aid, Jess has, for the past 8 years, served as Labour MP for Birmingham Yardley and has been Shadow Minister for Domestic Violence and Safeguarding since 2020. Away from the Commons, Jess has written 3 books, presented a very popular podcast, and hosted Have I Got News For You. Jess has said, "Look, I'm not going to stop women obsessing about the way they look. I don't stop obsessing about the way I look. So, in a profession in which one should be judged on what you say and what you do, should what you wear and how you look matter too? I want to know what role Jess thinks appearance plays in the Commons and on the doorstep. And are women in Parliament subject to a double standard, where certain male MPs seem able to turn dishevelment into a character trait?" Looking anything but dishevelled is my guest today, Jess Phillips. But before that, a massive thank you to our wonderful series sponsor, Skin & Me. Skin & Me is your most accessible, fast track to simplified skincare, offering powerful active ingredients in formulations you can't buy on the high street. Skin & Me can create a treatment for your specific skin concerns, tailored to you by experts. Whether you want to target adult acne, pigmentation, melasma, rosacea, or skin aging, this is powerful, personalized skincare that truly works. As someone who has used Skin & Me for years, I can honestly say I wouldn't go without it. Later in this series, I'm delighted to say we'll be joined by one of Skin & Me's very own dermatologists to answer any and all of your pressing skincare questions. You can submit your question by emailing btb@insanityhq.com. Now, on to today's episode of Beyond the Bathroom. So you are West Midlands born and bred.
Indeed.
And I always ask this question because I do think it can really dictate what happens the rest of your life and how you feel about your appearance. Tell me about the women in your family.
So definitely this has played a part in the way that I feel about my appearance. The women in my family, that my nan and my grandma were absolutely classic working class women who were obsessed with hygiene.
Yeah.
Rather than vanity.
House like a new pin.
Yes. Like they're obsessive about how you had to keep everything clean. Specifically, I'm going to say this, your vagina. My nan used to talk about the cleanliness.
Did she?
Yeah. Like always like, keep your hand on your opening. That was about your morality. But like, you know, the obsession like of like having to at any situation do what we used to call a whore's bath.
A whore's bath.
A whore's
yeah.
bath. Which my friend Amy hilariously thought was the word horse bath. And then what works like she was like, oh, I thought my mum was always saying horse. A whore's bath where like she sort of would obsessively take us upstairs to make sure that we were clean. There was a thing, real thing about cleanliness, cleaning out the gutters in your best finery and things. So my grandmother, who was incredibly glamorous, but died when I was very little because she smoked like a chimney when she was about 60. She in my head is this idea of sort of 1950s glamour. My nan was the kind of woman, nans don't look like this anymore, do they? Who had her hair done every week and
yeah.
had it set.
Yeah.
And there was definitely potions and lotions in my nan's house. In fact, if I think about my maternal nan, it's mainly like that she did have like powders and things that smelled and talked about rouge. The word rouge got said a lot.
So glam.
Yes. It was much more about being appearing smart, not appearing dirty, not appearing poor, was much more their effort. My mother, on the other hand, 1960s women's movement woman, never shaved her armpits and not even out of a, I don't even remember that being a political statement. just couldn't be asked.
Yeah.
I remember the first time she used to, I remember when I was little, she used to, these sort of weird round leg shaving things where you flicked, like you rotated the blade and you had like three options of the blade.
Yes, I remember those. You like pressed a button almost.
And it went round and she would shave her legs and I would sit and talk to her in the bath. She had a bath every morning. Again, she couldn't get away from the cleanliness thing and she would have a bath every morning. And I remember having to tell her when I was about 8 that she should pull up when she shaved her legs because she would do it down. And I was about 8 years old and I knew that probably from like just 17.
Yeah.
But my mother never wore hardly any makeup. She had very short hair. She was obsessive about her clothes and hygiene. She had beautiful clothes and always wanted to spend any money that she had on beautiful clothes. But she struggled with her weight. Like, and my nan used to be merciless to her about that. She'd say, I remember she once saying to me, like getting my mum to stand up, do like a 360, and said, can you believe when she was little, we had to hospitalise her because she was malnourished?
Oh, my
like,
word.
So, yeah. And my nan was the kind of woman who would go up to somebody in the street and say, that top is no friend of yours. Don't, you shouldn't wear that. It's been an error of judgment and you shouldn't make it again. I'm only being friendly. Like, so my nan was quite, you know, firm about appearances and what did and didn't look good and certainly about weight and things. And she was incredibly kind and lovely and generous, but there was definitely this sort of obsession with the way that you looked. But my mum did absolutely everything she possibly could to try and buck that in bringing me up and tried not to show that she was obsessing about her weight and things. But yeah, I didn't grow up in a house where anybody moisturised their skin or it was me and my mum and 4 massive blokes who lived in our house. In fact, 5 because my granddad lived there as well. And so there was not, you know, I didn't grow up with lotions and potions in my house. So my nan's house seemed like this magical place of smells of powder.
So where does that leave you? Because I know that you were extremely close to your mum and she was obviously,
extremely.
I mean, obviously such an important figure in anyone's life, but particularly for you. So where did that leave you? She was obviously trying to undo the kind of, I suppose, the toxicity, the unconscious toxicity that was around at that time, but she was consciously trying to undo it. So where did that leave you? When did you first become aware of how you looked?
I mean, not until I was probably about 13, it started to really matter to me and not before. And I think that that is very uncommon now. It comes much, much sooner. I had 3 brothers and so I wore their clothes. Like,
same.
You know, like I looked like a boy, like because and my mum cut my hair and when I was little, I always hated my fringe. My only association with doing anything to my appearance was that in the morning, because like everybody, I just had that sort of basin fringe in the 80s. It would stick up and I had cowlicks and like my brothers would laugh at me and things. And my brothers cottoned on very early on that calling you fat was the way to get at you. Even though, I mean, I was like not fat at all. It didn't really come, I think, until it's about sex, isn't it? It's I became sexualized at around the age of 12, 13. And I realized that my appearance had, well, what I perceived to be a power that I could use. I always had massive boobs. I had big boobs. I started my periods when I was like 8 and I had big boobs from, I mean, I was wearing a bra before I left primary school, like a proper bra. At primary school, I remember it being sort of like slightly jokey, noteworthy, but nothing particular. But when I went to secondary school, it like became a different thing that my body was something of note. And my mum undoubtedly would have been trying to undo that in me. But even then, there was absolutely, until even, in fact, not till I was much older, but I didn't wear any makeup or anything. I got up at 10 to 9. I'd rather sleep. The way that young women nowadays, my God, are going to schools and they must be getting up well early to be looking like they look to go to school. Whilst I knew that I had an hourglass figure and I had big boobs and a skinny waist and I started to recognise that my body was the sort of, at the time, sort of A-class desirable when I was about 12 or 13. I don't think I'd ever paid any mind to my appearance before that.
So we're coming back to your boobs with a vengeance. Lots to talk about there. But before that, you mentioned that you became aware when you, like all of us, are sexualised. And I think, yeah, about 12 is kind of it, isn't it? At which point, because I know you come from a really political family, both your parents, you've always been political, gifted membership of the party and so on. At which point did those two things merge to the point where you thought, well, actually, there is something socio-political going on here with women's appearances?
Oh, not until much later, even though, you know, I went to Women's Liberation Playgroup. So, you know, it was not like I wasn't surrounded by, I mean, literally women used to come and do like primal screams in my living room when I was a children,
yeah.
child. Like,
well,
weird.
I'm a Greenham child myself.
Yeah, yeah, well, yeah. likewise. So it just seemed like sort of weird women to me. I didn't really think anything of it. It's just like the wallpaper of life. It wasn't really actually until I was properly working, I think actually pregnancy. And I got pregnant when I was quite young, so I was 22. And I think at the point of being pregnant, I realised that just how much my body had become the property, not just of my baby, but like it was something else that wasn't mine and it had all these sort of connotations. Now, my mother had obviously spoken to me about sexual violence and domestic abuse and the whole thing about how women are treated and had constantly, they definitely, it was much more the way that they treated my body and my appearance was about strength and confidence.
Uh-huh.
So they had said, there's nothing you can't do that the boys can do. You can do anything. So, you know, you go and shimmy across that tightrope. You go and do it. And it was very much like, just be strong, use your body, make it strong. And that was the only way I'd ever really thought about it. But all the years of teenage years when we were hyper sexualized and going out with men who were much older than us and doing really, really risky, dangerous things. Funnily enough, back then in the sort of early to mid 90s, the obsession about women looking a certain way wasn't the same.
No, it wasn't.
It wasn't like we had to look a certain way. Definitely we wore short skirts and tiny little crop tops, which I notice are all back now, like wearing a Nike crop top with a mesh over the top to go to a rave. I look at my children now and I'm like, that I definitely had that top. But it was never really about like putting, like, I don't know, like sort of idea of male gaze was never obvious to us, although it was definitely there. We were doing it, but came out much more in wearing the right trainers, the grungy clothes, like it was much more about being seen as one of the lads more than like trying to be some sort of. And so I never really noticed it because I thought that.
And it wasn't documented. That's the other thing. So now everything is recorded. The way you look is
absolutely
photographed and posted.
Thank God it wasn't.
Absolutely, yeah.
It definitely was there, but I didn't feel it. I didn't feel the sort of pressure of womanhood and the way our appearance and our bodies until I was pregnant. And then it makes you reflect on all the dreadful things, all the years working in bars and like being treated a certain way, all the vicious, vile relationships and toxic things that you'd put yourself through start to become. And, I'm not a victim of any of this particularly. I was having fun, but it definitely started to feel political to me when I was pregnant. It started to feel like my
what
body was
what kind of thing? Were people touching you? Because I found that I was walking down the street one day and a woman put her hands on my bump to ward demons off herself.
Your talisman baby.
And I was absolutely fuming.
It was more that actually my body was starting to fail me in a way. Uh-huh. Like I was like not getting, I remember being told not to turn up for an interview for something because I had to go for a scan and they wouldn't redo it. And I started to feel really like, oh, like the decisions that women make about their bodies are detrimental to them. But also I started working with the very vulnerable women at the time, because I was not working full time and I was working with refugee women running planned stay groups when I'd had my baby. And just you start to then hear the stories of the kind of things that women have been put through, and it just started. We didn't have the language about like sexual exploitation. I didn't have that when I was a kid, but we definitely thought we were powerful, and we definitely thought we were powerful because of our bodies, undoubtedly.
When you ended up working in partner violence services, mm-hmm. As you and I have discussed before, I have a charity called Beauty Banks and we deal a lot with women's refuges. And I suppose prior to that, I'd never really understood, and I'm still trying to understand, the massive role a woman's appearance can play in the abuse that they suffer from men. So whether it's being incredibly hypercritical of a woman's appearance or controlling what she wears, what she puts on her face, what she doesn't put on her face, the way she has to use beauty to cover things up or as an armour. What kind of role did you see it playing in the... Because you worked for a long time in that world.
Long time. Funnily enough, women rely, and actually to their detriment sometimes, but there's no other way to survive on a genuine mask. So especially children. Children who have been sexually abused or sexually exploited, there is a sense that they put on a smiley face to hide from the world. And also it helps them cope. It's not just as a means of hiding, but some of that definitely comes out in masking. They want you to look somewhere else, so they will be very, like, have wild appearance in some regard, or like they don't want you to look at them, so the perfection has to be like you have to be unremarkable, not have any spots, not have any, and that definitely comes out. But also I would say on the positive side of it, I have absolutely seen, I remember once doing, so criminal injuries compensation is some money you can apply for after you have been a victim of a crime, certain crimes. And this one woman who had been raped and abused as a child and into adulthood. And I remember she was, we did her seeker application and she got the money and she went and had a boob job. afterwards, and I remember being like, oh, the patriarchy is strong. And then thinking, do you know what? That's her for the first time ever making a decision about her body. And actually, I felt like one of the more, I mean, I once did a seeker application for somebody who bought a gravestone for their brother. I'd rather somebody had a bit tit job, frankly.
Yeah.
But you have to constantly not put women, and women's appearances are used against them in a rape trial and in abuse that they suffer, not just by their perpetrator, obviously by society. So you have to put aside like the sort of Dolly Bird nature or the you know, the everything, just try and see the person all the time and hope that everything, that decision that they make about their appearance is them making it. You get women who are so glamorous after, like, it was their freedom was to be glamorous.
Yeah, we've dealt with women who have told us, or support workers who've told us anecdotally, that there are women who've never been allowed to wear makeup their whole marriage. Suddenly they get a bundle of stuff and they're like, woohoo, you know, this sort of reclamation that happens.
That definitely happens. And that, like, choosing their clothes and choosing the clothes for their children. And like my nan did, like, you know, she wanted us all to be as shiny as a pin. Women for the first time get this opportunity to make their families look shiny like a pin, and that's really, really, really nice to see. And also there is still so much of the language between women, it's obviously refuges, communal spaces, so much of the language between women is about, like, can I borrow this, have you got a hairbrush,
have you got any hairspray.
It provides like a real icebreaker, actually, the way that women will sit and talk in a sort of boudoir environment, like women's toilets. It's actually it's really important part of the culture of any sort of women's only space is that. And, like, you know, I like your lipstick, that sort of thing. Like, it's definitely something that those women lean on to get by and to find a community. And so, yeah, you know, all power to their elbows.
Yeah, we've had women, Jo Malone always give us tons and tons of perfume at Christmas to give women who've fled partner violence. And we've had women say, this is the first time I've worn a perfume that my husband didn't choose that I was allowed to wear. Yeah.
I mean, and also the thing about smell.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so evocative, isn't it?
Yeah.
Of memory and
you
triggering.
Want new smells.
We overuse the word triggering all the time. But actually, I think that either a piece of music or a smell is the thing that will catch me in a moment from before. So imagine, like, the acrid smell.
You
of
want
your
new
control.
Smells, don't you? Yeah.
You would want to smell of something fresh and new.
Before we return to our chat, here's a quick message from our wonderful series sponsor, Skin and Me. Skin and Me can help everyone achieve their best skin. Whether you want to target fine lines and wrinkles, skin texture and pores, adult acne, pigmentation, melasma or rosacea, or simply obtain a healthy skin glow, Skin and Me has a solution for you or a loved one. This is powerful, personalised skincare designed by experts with formulations you won't find on the high street, delivered directly to your door. Every single consultation and photo set submitted by Skin & Me members is personally reviewed by an expert dermatology clinician. Plus, all formulations are made to order and evolve as each skincare journey progresses, and regular check-ins with the dermatology team ensure Skin & Me members are always able to amend their treatment. Also, there's access to expert advice when you need it. No filters, just Skin & Me. Try your first month of personalised treatment from Skin & Me for $4.99 instead of the usual $24.99. Just visit skinandme.com and use the code SALLYANDME to get started. That's SALIANDME to get started. You mentioned beauty being such a kind of sort of bonding exercise between women. That's absolutely true. Another example of that, which I think entered the political space and was very frustrating, I think, for lots of people in my industry, was during COVID. Pubs were seen as an important part of daily life, but beauty businesses who had been trained in hygiene way before any other type of business were
They were wearing masks and stuff before.
The highest hygiene protocols of any industry outside of food, really, were the last to be able to go back to
just
work.
Sexism. Just plain and simple.
Talk to me about that. It is an overwhelmingly female industry in terms of workers and in terms of clientele. So did you feel that was at the root of the delay?
100%. I mean, there was actually at one point where there was like a sort of 3-week lag where men could genuinely go and get their beards done, but women couldn't have their nails done.
That's true.
And I remember being, and now as somebody, I don't have many regimes, but I get my nails done and I desperately need them doing at the moment. And I was honestly, I mean, my husband paints Warhammer figures, what he used to, and he's really, really brilliant at detail. And during the lockdown, I was like, you're going to have to adapt this and start doing nail art on me, mate.
But diversify.
Yeah, diversify. I don't mind if you make them look like, I don't know, like ogres, but whatever, I need them painting. But it was absolutely maddening, and absolutely the decisions that were made during the pandemic, and that is it's a really tangible and universal example. There are so many decisions where it was so obvious that there was nobody in the room at the Treasury making the decision
about business. Saying this stuff's important.
There was just no women there. Any woman would have been like, I mean, can you check out my bikini line?
Yeah.
Seriously, dudes, I need this doing. And actually lots of women were, people like Carolyn Harris were absolutely fighting to get the beauty industry back online. Of course, it's only because of sexism. It's because there weren't women in the room making those decisions. It's seen as being frippery. Our frippery has always been seen as being sort of like light and unicorns and like, oh, that's nice, little girl. It's to infantilise women and their needs. Whereas men were allowed to go and have their beards done.
Go to Formula One, go to the football.
Formula One is not more important than nails.
No. It's simply not. No,
it's not. I mean, everybody has nails.
I think one amazing thing that did happen as a result of that unfairness, or alongside it at least, is that I think there was newfound appreciation for how important those businesses are in our communities, to the way women socialise, to the way women feel. All those female small business owners with nail bars, with hair salons, with beauty salons and all of that. I feel like those businesses have been more appreciated since COVID.
I would say that is absolutely true. And also it started because it's not never been a particularly political field.
No.
Because it sort of leaned into its power and it became a political argument. And actually, even just the terminology that we use to describe small businesses in this country, what we say is white van man. We say your plumbers, your bloke who's got two labourers and a van and he's just running it from his head. Well, why don't we ever talk about those women. We never, the terminology, their space in the political environment just doesn't exist. So why is it not a mobile hairdresser that we are talking about? I literally would not be able to live without mine. If it was like, you know, I'd rather not have hot water and not have a plumber than not have Kim come round my house and cut my hair.
Well, we saw the power of it during the repeal movement in Ireland, where there was a whole network of nail bars giving out leaflets and talking to their clients.
So I think actually what it did was it made them a political force in a way that they hadn't been before.
Yeah.
And it is just, we have to maintain that women's jobs, the amount of women entrepreneurs and women small businesses is just totally ignored by the political class. And that, I don't think that would happen again now. I think that there is an element where they are much more powerful. And I have banks and big finance houses and stuff coming in saying, how do we get more women like to set up businesses and do this, that and the other? How can we be helping these businesses? So there has definitely been a change where they are seen as being they are an important part of our infrastructure.
Yeah.
That's the reality. Those small businesses are a massive part of our infrastructure.
Yeah. Talking about the political side of things for you day to day, there is an impossible expectation for female MPs. There's a sort of perfect level of attractiveness, isn't there? This sort of Penny Mordaunt, basically.
Yeah.
So you need to be pretty enough to escape abuse as best you can, but not too pretty to be unable to be taken seriously. Do you feel it on the front line?
Yes, much more so than I used to, funnily enough. It was very, very oppressive in the beginning when I was first elected that people would comment on. I suppose it's because it comes a bit of a shock, especially when you go from working at Women's Aid where you're only working with women. Like, you know, people are only nice to your face about, like, oh, I like that dress. Oh, have you lost a bit of weight? You know, people are only making nice passing comments about your appearance in that environment. And then to go to an environment where literally people can't write anything about you, even if they're writing almost exclusively about what you are saying and the important thing you are saying, there is always some passing comment to what you were wearing or in the heat. I am so glad to be a woman in Parliament, I have to say, is the only upside.
Yeah, right, because they're in a suit.
Because they're oh my God, I look at them and it makes me feel sad that wearing a suit, and I'm glad that I don't have to do that. But it is such a protection for the men in Parliament that there is a uniform, like a drone style uniform. So in every, apart from in the heat where we finally get the upside, it definitely protects them. And if you're a feminist, it'll be like, oh, well, she hates men because she's a lady. Like, you know, it has to be because you couldn't get laid or you could. And it is just like, oh, my God.
Well, I remember. So you'll remember the year. But I remember, wasn't there a UKIP candidate who was speculating about whether or not you were hot enough for him to rape you?
Yeah. Absolutely. In his speculation, thousands of other people then leaned into.
Of course.
Yes. Whether a person is hot enough to rape, which is an entire misunderstanding of the crime of rape.
Yes, however, completely.
Like only hot women could be raped.
Yeah.
I mean, that when it gets down to being like at that level, like where your appearance is so scrutinized to the point that you're not even worthy of a crime.
Yeah.
It is absolutely maddening. The most maddening thing about it, though, is just so distracting. It's so distracting and it takes up time. And it makes me, when I make decisions about what I'm going to wear, it makes me feel sad if I'm not making them entirely of my own volition. Or I'm not appearing at something because of that. That makes, like, I'm absolutely fine to obsess about my appearance on my own terms, but I'm not
in order to just do your job.
Just to have to think about it. And I used to think when Theresa May was, who is a natty dresser.
Leather trousers. That's all I think about. Yeah. Theresa May's leather
trousers.
That was such a scandal. So for anyone listening who doesn't remember this, Theresa May did a magazine interview. Yeah. She wore a pair of, I think, Joseph brown leather trousers that were perfectly nice. As you say, she's a decent dresser. The pictures came out and people went bananas because these trousers were so expensive. Now, anybody who's ever worked in the media knows that they wouldn't have belonged to her, those trousers. The stylist would would have brought them, she would have worn them, and then they would have gone back to Joseph. Yeah. But everyone went bananas about it. And at the time, the number of things to talk about around Theresa May for 3 weeks were infinite.
Yeah, and leather trousers wasn't one of them.
Yeah, leather trousers wasn't one of them, but it became this thing.
But I used to think that when she got up in the morning... So David Cameron was the Prime Minister when I was first elected, and then it was Theresa May. I used to think when she got up in the morning, she had to think.
Yeah.
She had to spend like a good half an hour thinking, looking through her diary, thinking about the events she was
doing. The mental gymnastics of it all.
And I just thought, if she had that half an hour back, like the productivity. Now, I'm fine if she wants to take half an hour. If she wants to take half an hour and like, because there's literally nothing I love more. Sometimes I'm sat down watching the telly and I think, I'm just going to go and dry my clothes on.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, like, yeah, yeah. I'm like, it's like a delightful pastime. I really, really like doing it.
Yeah.
To be forced to do it because of the way you're going to be perceived, because you are a woman. When I just know that David Cameron got up and like went like Homer Simpson to his wardrobe and they were all the same outfit. And he just went, I'll wear this blue suit today. And I just think that the amount of time she must have lost when she could have been running the country or like, you know, telling idiots backbenchers to piss off. She had to think about it. And that's the fundamental for me is always I get really annoyed at the amount of time that women have to give to this other stuff, the level of productivity that we would be able to get back if we didn't have to constantly micromanage our personal safety, constantly micromanage how we might be perceived because of the clothes we're wearing. You know, things like wearing a low-cut top is really, over the years of politics, has become unbelievably controversial, because if you do it, like, it will like be in a newspaper
and what you've said will be forgotten,
totally and utterly forgotten. It's like, oh, I could see a bit of cleavage. Mm-hmm. And people then write to you, send mm-hmm. you emails like that, you
put them away, love,
very good points, and it's like a shit sandwich. You were making very good points, but it was very distracting because I could see your cleavage. Mm-hmm. And it's just like that. What the fuck is wrong with
yeah.
you?
Yeah.
Like, if you are so distracted by a line of skin possibly show, it's not like, you know, I had like nipple tassels on yeah. and had gone on, you know, the world at one. It just was like, you know, you could see the slight top of my chest. And that was so distracting to you
yeah.
that you couldn't listen to me talking about a coup in Russia. What is wrong with you?
I mean, the most stark difference is, so we had Theresa May, who was constantly, the shoes she wore, her kitten heels, endless pieces written about the way she dressed, the leather trousers, the hair, is she trying to look more attractive, legs it, all of that sort of mad stuff. And, you know, I would argue, as much as I disagree with basically everything Theresa May has ever said in her life, I would say that she is somebody who was at least driven by a sense of public service and was 100%. Trying to do things I didn't agree with, but was actually trying to get stuff done. So all of this stuff constantly about Theresa May. And then we have a prime minister whose entire brand is that he looks like he was fished out of a skip. These are my words, not Jess's.
He looks like he was fished out of a skip. My husband, every time he does that running thing, he's like, and he goes running in a shirt. He's like, why is Boris Johnson pretending that he goes running? Stop pretending, Boris Johnson. His hair, I mean, he gave, I have to say, the only good thing about Boris Johnson's honour list recently was that he gave, I think it was an OBE, to the hairdresser in Parliament, who'd obviously done his hair. And the only reason Boris Johnson did it is because he wanted to remind everybody that he had funny hair.
Yeah.
But she's a cracking woman. So,
well, that's pleasing that a hairdresser...
I'm glad that she got the honour.
The legendary, great hairdresser Sam McKnight said repeatedly throughout Johnson's tenure, hair doesn't do that on its own.
Yeah, oh God.
That is a conscious decision.
I mean, I've literally watched him walk onto a stage and ruffle up his hair
right.
before he goes on.
Right.
That is a fact. Boris Johnson is nothing like he appears in real life, in private. He's uh-huh. quiet and shy and nervous, and he acts a little bit like a boy who you're about to scold at any minute uh-huh. whenever he's talking to you. He is not bombastic. He's actually very, very quiet. And then it's like, you know, it's like war paint, isn't it? He ruffles up his yeah. hair and then he's the Boris Johnson yeah. that you see. And it's totally fake. It's totally and utterly fake. You know what? I don't even care
no.
if it's fake. Just own it.
There is no way a woman with that level of personal grooming could ever rise to power, even probably as an MP, never mind.
But a working class person couldn't either. A working class man who turned up for a job interview looking like that would not get the job.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
I would have to say, you know, I spend time with people who, you know, and I've worked with people who were homeless, lived on the streets, and you put so much effort into helping them get clothes, helping them get presentable, how they should present when going to interviews and things. And he, you know, it's like a joke to him to look. My nan would have been absolute. He would have felt the back of her cold, bony hand.
Oh, I mean, my granddad would not be seen dead.
I mean,
like, it would not be seen dead.
No working class family would ever have allowed. And it's class, it's gender, it's all of those things that he could never get away with that. If I went out with my hair looking like that, I mean, I'd just be mocked.
Well, sticking with you, so I read, so Julie Birchall once wrote that you look more like someone you'd see on The X Factor than on The Andrew Marr Show. Now, but, you know, that may have been a compliment from Julie Birchall. It may have been an insult. I don't know.
I think it was a compliment.
But what struck me about it is there's an expectation that people who do serious things and talk about serious things, as you do, need to look a certain way. And people who do something that doesn't matter, that are frivolous, look another way. Is that something you encounter? Because I get this all the time. You know, I was having a big conversation about Russia with somebody and they said, oh God, I didn't, you know, I'm quite surprised that you would know about this because you write a beauty column. And this is, but this is a really common thing with women if you look
like
at certain...
Like you switch off after you've been thinking about perfume and you just sit in a dark room like a robot.
Yeah. And so is there an expectation that you have to look this very... Because I know that you're somebody who likes to go out with your girls and put your slap on.
That, I mean, all of... that definitely is the case, is that there's a certain level of... And I have work clothes. I think most people do have work clothes, like, that I wouldn't wear. And because I live in two different places, when I'm at Westminster work and when I'm at Birmingham work, I mean, in Birmingham, I dress exactly like I would dress any time. Uh-huh. I wear jeans, T-shirts to work, trainers. I mean, I wear trainers to work in Westminster all the time. And I try really hard to push against the idea that I'm meant to dress a certain way. Although there are actual... rules in Westminster about what you are and aren't allowed to wear. So you're not meant to wear trainers in the chamber.
Oh, right, okay.
I would never wear trainers if I was sitting on the front bench, but I always wear trainers when I'm sitting on the back bench because who can tell?
Yeah.
You're not allowed
like
to wear...
a newsreader.
Yes,
no one can
exactly.
See.
Yeah. You're not allowed to wear open toe sandals. Again, I do all the time. In fact, almost every single woman breaks that rule. Big bags. There's a thing about, you know, like having a big bag. I suppose that's about space. But
yeah.
Still as well.
The chamber is too small.
The chamber is too small, but often it's empty. And so my big bag will be fine. Thanks. I try and dress like the people that I represent, not out of like, you know, like I'm cosplaying to be like them.
Mm-hmm.
I am one of them. Like, I don't feel the need to look needlessly smart all the time. I quite like sometimes dressing up like, you know,
sure.
Actually, if I'm ever cosplaying, I'm cosplaying in a suit. I'm like that. Ooh, look at me. I'm like in a suit.
And do you think that would be a barrier on the doorstep, looking too smart?
Oh, no. They're actually people quite... I mean, it depends in which community. Working class communities actually like you to look quite smart.
To make the effort.
But they don't mind if they don't mind if you're one of them, you don't. If you're like an interloper from, like, say, a London person went up and was like knocking on doors in Bury and you didn't wear a suit, they would probably think, who are you? Fancy pants. Actually thinking you're better. There's a sort of sign of respect in, like, in certain communities that you dress smartly on a doorstep. I wouldn't ever do that in my constituency, like, because life's too short to go home and put a suit on to go and knock on people's door in either the boiling sun or the pissing rain. But and they know me, so they wouldn't expect it of me. But there is definitely, there's a sort of fine balance, but actually quite a lot, you know, my nan, she reigns supreme in lots and lots of parts of our country. That attitude that you, like, I mean, she made my granddad go on the roof to clean the drains in a suit, like, you know, at least a pullover with a shirt and tie.
Yes, that was like, the granddad uniform.
Yeah, shirt and tie with a pullover. And like, my mum had to wear her school uniform when she went on holiday because that was her best clothes. Hilarious photos of them in like on the sun making sandcastles in like a blazer. It's like, what are you doing, lunatics? Only came out when I was a child, really, in that your best clothes were the ones you took on holiday and you'd pack them like 3 weeks before, so you'd have nothing to wear for like 3 weeks before you went on holiday.
Yeah.
Ridiculous. I don't do that with my kids. So the idea that you look smart, I don't mind it when it is to respect that.
Uh-huh.
I do mind it when it is because people will think I'm stupid if I don't do it. Those are two different things. The way that you will be written about, the way that you'll be perceived essentially by people from the upper classes,
yeah,
if you don't look smart, that I really like to push the envelope on. And in Parliament, any rule that anyone tries to give me, I am a bit like that. I'm going to stick two fingers up to that rule, I'm afraid. I'm going to wear trainers because my feet hurt otherwise.
It reminds me of something I read that you'd said when I was researching this. You said, I loathe and detest people who pretend they don't care what people think about them as if that is a virtue when it is simply rude.
It is, yeah. Why would you be like that? I just don't care what people think about me.
I speak as I find. If I hate you, I'll tell you to your face.
No, it's like, it's the years, isn't it, of the sort of initial phase of reality TV where all women felt that they had to go on and be like,
yeah,
basically like, I got to be true to myself.
Yeah.
And, you know,
what
I'm
going to
tell
get.
You, like a woman the other day in Parliament, she's the MP for Grimsby. She stood up in the debate about Boris Johnson and whether he should be kicked out of Parliament. And she said, I'm from Grimsby, I can only speak as I find. So I stood up and said, well, I'm from Birmingham. Like, where are you saying that people are just liars? Like, you know what I mean? Like, are you saying that geographically there's some places where people are liars?
Yeah.
Like, it's such a stupid thing to say.
It's just manners.
Yeah. Just don't be a dick is the basic rule of life. I lie when out of kindness to people all the time. I don't need to speak as I find.
Of course.
Also, for women, and I assume men are doing this, although my husband is rubbish at it, you know, slag people off behind their backs. It's an age-old thing.
Talk to your friends in private is basically
the rule. You don't need to be telling people to their faces.
No.
I mean, my nan definitely fell foul of that at times.
it's the arrogance, isn't it, in assuming that people must know your negative opinion of them. For many complicated and inevitable reasons, women are dicks to themselves, right?
Yeah,
and
much more so than anyone else.
Exactly. And you've said on lots of occasions that there's a sort of growing sense that young women should like themselves a bit more.
Yeah.
And I read an anecdote of yours where you were on the train and you saw two women ask their male colleagues to appraise their appearance. I mean, that's a particularly stark and depressing example. But what are you seeing about women and their appearances that needs to be more positive for the sake of us all?
Well, I mean, I don't care at all about women obsessing about their appearance if it's for them. Like, it's male gaze and social expectation that worries me. And I really want women to praise themselves as much as, like, most women I know will be like, oh, you know, my arse is massive, or like, oh, I just really hate my arms. I don't remember before.
It's a thing, isn't it?
Like, that did not come in the 80s and 90s. No one was paying attention to arms. Arms have become a big thing. People really hate their arms, and women will sort of obsessively talk, and I'm fine with that, obsessively talk about the things that they don't like. I just wish it was metered with the alternative. I went away with my girlfriends, you know, out on the town, and we're all taking selfies, and I was saying, like, I am brilliant at taking a selfie. I look amazing in a selfie because I've got great cheekbones.
I'm saying
it out loud at the same time as being like that. I hate my stomach. Like, just, it's got to be tempered with what you do like about yourself, otherwise it just becomes totally negative all the time and you can't look in a mirror. I mean, most women will go through periods in their lives, even the most beautiful people with absolutely perfect figures and beautiful faces and amazing hair will not be able to bear to look in a mirror.
And like, it's you'll rush often past about the- something else, isn't it? I wrote a piece years ago for a women's glossy about, you know, this sort of cliche of, I'm having a fat day, I feel fat today, I can't wear that, I feel fat today. So studies have been done where they found that women who have to keep a diary on their fat days, that never corresponds mathematically to how heavy they actually are on that day, because it's always about something else.
It's always about,
I feel I've got my period, I feel a bit crap, or I've had an argument with my kid, or I couldn't get my kid to school on time, or something's going on at work, or I hate this jumper.
When you're stressed, your clothes hurt, you don't.
Yeah,
they literally physically cause you restrictive pain.
Yeah.
If I were to say that to my husband, he would be like, what are you talking about?
Yeah,
you lunatic.
Yeah,
because, you know, he's just wearing a pair of jeans and a t-shirt.
Yeah,
that's what he's wearing his whole life. Sometimes I can feel like my clothes are literally strangling me.
Yeah.
Like it's a physical reaction.
Hot day.
And I'm especially like as you're getting your period and things like that. It just is so horrendous. And bras and knickers don't help, do they? Because they're basically fairly uncomfortable. I mean, that I gave up a long time ago, wearing like uncomfortable knickers. I don't know what I was thinking as a teen. I was just hoping someone would see them, I suppose. But you can feel so awful about it. And I want people to note when they don't. Like, there are days, you know, like when your hair just goes perfect and you don't know how it's happened. I just want people to really be like, oh,
my hair looks good.
Oh, doesn't my hair look good? Yeah. Oh, I'm having a great hair day. And so I try and do it. It feels painful to do it, to like big yourself up. But I try and do it because I want other women to be like, oh, you know, I look absolutely $1 million today. I've got a friend called Ruth, and she is has the most healthy body image. I've never known a person be as positive about the way she looks. And it's not conceited in any way. She never worries about what she eats. She's never worried. She just wants to be healthy. She will be like that. Check me out. This dress, I look absolutely killer in it. And then she'll send photos to the WhatsApp group. So I just remembered I looked ace in this outfit.
I love that. Yeah. I'd be delighted if a friend sent me that.
I mean, we must spend solid hour a day, like literally verbalising the things we don't like about our appearance.
Yeah. Oh, I love your dress. You look lovely. It's only Primark.
Yeah, that's it. Cost a pound. I literally did that as I came in. Someone was like, I like your jacket. I was like, it's from Vinted, £5. Like, it's like, what is wrong with us? We verbalise it all the time. If you stood in front of a mirror in a communal bathroom with another woman, for some reason, we go like this. We look in the mirror and we go, oh, look at the back. Like, you've never met this woman before.
Yeah.
She doesn't know you. And yet here you are immediately pointing out your flaws.
I
and
get
like
it
if you've got a spot,
time.
You walk into a meeting and say, I've got a massive spot. I'm what is wrong?
I get
this?
It all the time. I meet women at book events and I go, God, you look fab, because I always pay a compliment. And you know, I'm like, you look fab, and they go, but I've got a cold sore coming. It's like I can't even see it.
Yeah, exactly. We spend so much time verbalizing how shit we look. I have no idea why we do it. And it's too easy to blame the beauty industry. That became like the sort of go-to, didn't it, for ages? Just like blame advertising.
Skinny
and the
models.
Yeah. I remember when I did a thing for Vogue. I was in Vogue. You know, it's unbelievable. When I was a kid and somebody had told me,
you're
going to come and do a shoot at your house, I'd have been like, this? Really? Are you joking? And it was under Edward Enning. For who definitely has gone in for the idea of beauty being a different thing. I remember them saying to me, we want you to know that obviously because of like feminism and things, we don't do like any airbrushing or anything. And I was like, oh, I want you to know that I want you to airbrush the shit out of me.
I'd like to look like a manga animation at the
I
end.
I didn't bother to not eat carbs for the week before this. So if you could make my legs look ridiculously long, if you could make me look like how I think I looked when I was 14 in my head,
yeah,
that'd be cracking, if you wouldn't mind.
So there was a part of your body and your body image that you weren't happy with.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you're happy to talk about this. So anybody who follows me will know that in 2020, just pre-COVID, I had a breast reduction. I wrote about it for Vogue. And made some videos on the whole procedure, da, 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 da. And you popped up in my DMs and said, I'm thinking about this. So tell me how you got there and what happened next.
Yeah, so I'm not a person who at all usually obsesses about my appearance at all. I mean, that's not true. I obsess about my appearance all the time. But I don't do anything to my skin or anything. I'm not like worried about like my aging particularly. Mm-hmm. But I always had massive boobs. I mean, I got my boobs when I when I was about 8, and they were huge. And I used to look, I mean, as a teenager, absolutely loved them.
Yeah.
Thought, I'm the bee's knees. I've got massive tits. This is a good thing. This was definitely a good thing. Even though it was like heroin chic back then and people were meant to be really thin, I was definitely like...
Some things never go out of style though, do they?
Tits always going to be fashionable. So I had really big boobs. And then it got to the point when I was about 19 and I was at university, and maybe for the first time in my life I'd actually put on weight, because you start to dive with your metabolism very early on, and also...
And pill and all of that
The
stuff.
Pill, and also just like eating pizza every night.
Yeah.
Not like having my mum and dad cook for me anymore.
Yeah.
Meant that I just ate crap. So I put on weight and my boobs became... like so huge and like a shelf in front of me, so massive that I just started to really, really hate them. And so at the time, I went and asked if I could have a breast reduction on the NHS. Mm-hmm. In fact, I was living with a woman called Debbie who told me her auntie had had one. Mm-hmm. I went along and had the consultation and they said, yeah, look, you know, you would definitely qualify. You have very big boobs. I mean, they were like, I had a small back, so I was 32. Mm-hmm. And they were like, I mean, double G, double H, like mm-hmm. they were massive. Mm-hmm. And it was starting to hurt my back. I still have terrible posture. Because you start to try and sort of
you
hide it.
You absolutely do, yeah.
And my posture is still really bad because of it and my back still suffers because of it. They put me on the waiting list at the time and obviously it's not of vital importance. I wasn't going to die of having big boobs. So I was on the waiting list for a while and it crossed over me getting pregnant.
Okay.
And so then at that point,
you're
I was
out
like,
of the game.
I'm out of the game for a couple of years because I need to breastfeed and my boobs have now stopped being about that and started being
about
this. They have an actual function. I then sort of put it off. And obviously, two babies later, lots of breastfeeding later, my boobs were just, I mean, I think when
they
I went to...
They get heavy
and it was painful. I just hated the appearance of them. I lost a huge amount of weight and no matter how much weight I lost, I would never lose it off my boobs.
Yeah.
And then I saw your video and then I was like that, oh my God, I remembered I was going to do this thing. Like I'd forgotten, like in the years of being a mom. And also now I have more money than I ever had before. I have more disposable income than I have ever had in my life. And so I saw your video and I was like, oh my God, like you made it seem like it was like, basically the thing I needed to be told was I wasn't going to have to take loads of time off work.
Yeah, no.
And that was the barrier for me.
I had a day on the sofa.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, and I was like, oh God, look, I could definitely do this. And my friend, Ruth, who is my most body confident friend, she had recently gone and had a breast enlargement.
Wow.
And really loved her surgeon. And she's a medical professional herself. So
oh,
the sort
great.
Of yeah,
so that's
like,
a good recommendation.
There was a level of trust that I trusted her about. And so I went and had the consultation and the surgeon said to me, I mean, I can't remember whether it was grade 3 or grade 4, but whichever one it was the worst one. She said I had that level of droop.
Where you can pop a Yellow Pages under there and
exactly,
it would stay there.
So heavy that they were just being literally, they were dragging me to the floor.
Yeah.
And no matter how much weight I lost, I always just looked like I had a shirt. I couldn't wear a t-shirt.
Yeah.
I couldn't wear anything that was like floaty and I don't like the heat. So that
hot
was a problem.
Hot and sweaty under there.
Because it just made me look like a tent.
Yeah.
And I was like, honestly, I'm thin under this.
Yeah.
I want people to know that I'm thin under this outfit. But if I wore anything tight...
You become sexy Jess, don't you?
Like Jessica Rabbit, literally. Yeah. Like, this is ridiculous.
That's what I hated as well. You can either be really frumpy or sexy.
Yeah, I'm like that. I just want to be me. Yeah. I just want to wear a t-shirt.
I just want to not be sweating buckets from my boobs.
Exactly. So I went and I had a breast reduction. And it's literally the greatest thing I've ever done in my life. I never look back on it with anything but utter delight. I feel really, 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 really happy. And when I hate everything else about my body, in those days when I hate everything else about my body, I will literally take a look at my tits in a mirror and be like, cracking tits.
Yeah. Yeah.
My tits look amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty happy myself.
Yeah, I'm like that. Like the other day, I was putting a bra on and you're like making it go into the cup.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Do it. And like my nipple came out. I thought that would never have happened. Like it was like up here. I was like that. This is amazing. Like this is amazing.
So we formed a little movement. So after I posted those videos, you messaged me. A few other high-profile women messaged me, but then tons and tons of readers and followers messaged me. And it got to the point where I was sending my post-surgical bras to some women. I was sending my leftover scar tape to other women.
Yeah.
I think probably at this point there are about 50 of us who message me and go, I'm at this stage or I'm going in next week for it done. And everybody's just sharing information.
It is.
And not one person has come out of it and not said, oh my God, why didn't I do it forever ago? Because I didn't do it forever ago because I couldn't have afforded it.
Yeah,
you get to a point 100%. Where you've got enough money if you're lucky and you can have it done. But prior to that, you're not wasting time. You just can't afford it. But knowing what I know now, I think I would have sold something if I'd known. I would have sold a car or something.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Because the effect it has
on your
life.
It's made me healthier.
Yeah.
It's literally made me healthier. It's made me able to exercise in a way that I was never able to exercise.
Yeah.
It's actually made me just like the rest of my body a lot better. It's been good for my mental health. It's been good for my physical health. I would 100% recommend to anybody thinking of doing it. And funnily enough, out of my sort of like seven very close friends, three of us have now had our breasts augmented in some way, all by the same surgeon. We like to say we've got identical boobs. None of them ever regret it. Like, it is absolute, and it was totally 100% for me. I mean, I've been married for 20 years. My husband could not have given an arse one way or another what my boobs look like, but it is totally for me. And actually spending that money on my appearance, I will, you know, just felt really, I felt like you earned this money. Like,
it's such an unwomanly thing to do, because as a woman, discomfort, part of being a woman, physical discomfort, part of being a woman, putting your family first, part of being a woman. So when you do something like that, it feels quite subversive.
It does. It does. And it felt like, especially because, you know, there's, I suppose, even just any sort of anaesthetic, there's risks. And I was like, I kept thinking of Kanye's mum. I kept being like, oh, what if I die of tits? Yeah. That will definitely be the headline. Yeah. I can't die of having my tits done. It genuinely felt, and this is how I feel about putting makeup on, actually, and having my nails done. It is the only thing that is 100% for me, funded by me, my efforts, my time, for me. And that, like, that is like therapy. I don't need anything else. That time is like therapy to me. And I was not raised with loads of makeup and skincare regimes. I don't moisturise my skin. I don't do any of that. But there is something about sitting before you go on the television and having your makeup done, and I take the time and I sit and I enjoy it. And it is like putting war paint on, but it is also just a moment where it's just
self-care.
And I can't do anything else because, like, there's people in my face, or like when you I can't look at my phone. Although once Theresa May did literally ring me from the Downing Street switchboard while I was having my nails done. I was like on loudspeaker saying, don't say anything. You're in a nail bar.
Literally the worst environment for you to tell a secret.
Do not. This is going to go like wildfire. But I can't do anything else in that time.
Yeah.
And that feels subversive. That feels subversive to me. And so the boobs was just like the very next level. Like, and then like my husband was like looking after me, and which he does all the time. But it felt really like, I remember my mother-in-law made me some buns that looked like boobs. And it just felt like, you know, well done. You did this for you. I feel really pleased about it.
And did you get any shit over it? Because I didn't tell anyone. So I knew that you'd had them done, because you and I had kept in touch about, where are you at? You'd just had the surgery. It was over Christmas, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And I didn't tell anybody, because I thought that will end up in the Daily Mail, that she spent thousands of pounds on a silly thing that girls get.
Yeah, no, I mean, I didn't, I never was not public about it. I never kept it secret, but I didn't specifically go out and tell the world that I'd had it done. I think, I mean, Angela Rayner recently talked about how when she was younger, she'd had a boob job, which I was not surprised to hear, because I'd once seen her boobs and thought, my God, they are absolutely
cracking. They're too good to be true.
Yeah, I was like, has Angela Rayner got a amazing boob, and now I know that feels good. I lived with her for a spell when we were first elected, and that's how I saw her boobs. Although women get changed in front of each other all the time. I do feel like there is a little bit more, like, we can say this stuff now. Like, the thing that I was worried about is the idea of spending money on healthcare is the thing that you would get criticized for. But do you know what? Like, it's a bit like when I was either when I did Vogue or when I was on the front of the Times magazine, and like with Theresa May and the trousers, admittedly, like I was wearing like a silver leather jacket in one that probably cost more than my first car.
Sure.
And I as you know, I didn't get to keep it. Alas, if they'd offered it to me, I definitely would have. And people are like, oh, you know, how do you think your constituents feel about you? Mm-hmm. I said, if you were to walk up to anyone in my constituency and say, do you want to spend all day getting dressed up in fancy clothes? They'd be like, yes, please. Like, they are not going to judge me for wanting to have my boobs done. And I was never secretive about it from them. Like, you know, if any, you know, I've talked to my constituents, if they ask, I'll be like, oh yeah, I had a boob job. I'm not secret about it. But yeah, there is definitely that people could definitely slag me off for it, but let them. I'm fine with it. My tits look cracking and I'm just much happier.
Thank you. Well, I think we should end on your cracking tits, because
they are
why
cracking.
Wouldn't you? That's it for this episode. Thank you so much to the brilliant Jess Phillips for putting her best face forward. Please subscribe and follow Beyond the Bathroom wherever you get your podcasts. And if you enjoy the show, please leave a rating and a review. I'll see you next time with another guest. Thanks, Jess. Insanity Group.